Hunger was good discipline. You got very hungry when you did not eat enough in Paris because all the bakery shops had such good things in the windows, and people ate outside at tables on the sidewalks so that you saw and smelled the food. When you had given up journalism and were writing nothing that anyone in America would buy, explaining at home that you were lunching out with someone, the best place to go was the Luxembourg Gardens, where you saw and smelled nothing to eat, all the way from the Place de l'Observatoire to the Rue de Vaugirard. There, you could always go into the Luxembourg Museum, and all the paintings were sharpened and clearer and more beautiful if you were belly empty, hollow, hungry. I learned to understand Cézanne much better and to see truly how he made landscapes when I was hungry. I used to wonder if he were hungry too when he painted, but I thought possibly it was only that he had forgotten to eat. It was one of those unsound but illuminating thoughts you have when you have been sleepless or hungry. Later, I thought Cézanne was probably hungry in a different way. After you came out of the Luxembourg, you could walk down the narrow Mayfereau to the Place Saint-Sulpice, and there were still no restaurants, only the quiet square with its benches and trees. There was a fountain with lions and pigeons walking on the pavement and perched on the statues of the bishops. There was the church, and there were shops selling religious objects and vestments on the north side of the square. From this square, you could not go further towards the river without passing shops selling fruits, vegetables, wines, or bakery and pastry shops. But by choosing your way carefully, you could work to your right around the gray and white stone church and reach the Rue de l'Odéon, and turn up to your right towards Sylvia Beach's bookshop, and on your way, you did not pass too many places where things to eat were sold. The Rue de l'Odéon was bare of eating places until you reached the square, where there were three restaurants. By the time you reached 12 Rue de l'Odéon, your hunger was contained, but all of your perceptions were heightened again. The photographs looked different, and you saw books that you had never seen before. "You're too thin, Hemingway," Sylvia would say. "Are you eating enough?" "Sure." "What did you eat for lunch?" My stomach would turn over, and I would say, "I'm going home for lunch now." "At 3 o'clock?" "I didn't know it was that late." "Adriana said the other night she wanted to have you and Hadley for dinner. We asked Farg. You like Farg, don't you? Or Labod? You like him. I know you like him. Or anyone you really like. Will you speak to Hadley?" "I know she'd love to come. You send her a pneu. Don't you work so hard now that you don't eat properly?" "I won't." "Get home now before it's too late for lunch." "They'll save it. Don't eat cold food either. Eat a good hot lunch. Did I have any mail?" "I don't think so, but let me look." She looked and found a note and looked up happily and then opened a closed door in her desk. "This came while I was out," she said. "It was a letter and it felt as though it had money in it." "Wettercup," Sylvia said. "It must be from dear Keshnit. Did you see Wettercup?" "No. But he was here with George. He'll see you. Don't worry. Perhaps he wanted to pay you first." "It's 600 francs. He says there will be more. I'm awfully glad you reminded me to look." "Dear Mr. Awfully Nice. It's damned funny that Germany is the only place I can sell anything. To him and to the Frankfurter Zutnug. Isn't it? But don't you worry ever. You can sell stories to Ford," she teased me. 30 francs a page. Say one story every 3 months in the Transatlantic. Story 5 pages long makes 150 francs a quarter, 600 francs a year. But Hemingway, Don't worry about what they bring now. The point is that you can write them. I know I can write them, but nobody will buy them. There is no money coming in since I quit journalism. They will sell. Look, you have the money for one right there. I'm sorry, Sylvia. Forgive me for speaking about it. Forgive you for what? Always talk about it or about anything. Don't you know all writers ever talk about is their troubles? But promise me you won't worry and that you'll eat enough. I promise. Then get home now and have lunch. Outside on the Rue del Dion, I was disgusted with myself for having complained about things. I was doing what I did on my own free will, and I was doing it stupidly. I should have bought a large piece of bread and eaten it instead of skipping a meal. I could taste the brown, lovely crust, but it is dry in your mouth without something to drink, you goddamn complainer. You dirty, phony saint and martyr, I said to myself. You quit journalism of your own accord. You have credit, and Sylvia would have loaned you money. She has plenty of time. Sure. And then the next thing you would be compromising on something else. Hunger is healthy, and the pictures do look better when you are hungry. Eating is wonderful, too. And do you know where you are going to eat right now? Lips is where you are going to eat and drink, too. It was a quick walk to Lips in every place I passed that my stomach noticed, and quickly as my eyes or my nose made the walk an added pleasure. There were few people in the brasserie, and when I sat down on the bench against the wall with the mirror in back and a table in front, and the waiter asked if I wanted a beer, I asked for a distingué. The big glass mug that held a liter. And for a potato salad. The beer was very cold and wonderful to drink. The pommes à l'huile were firm and marinated, and the olive oil delicious. I ground black pepper over the potatoes and moistened the bread in the olive oil. After the first heavy draft of beer, I drank and ate very slowly. When the pommes à l'huile were gone, I ordered another serving and a cervelat. This was a sausage like a heavy, wide frankfurter, split in two and covered with a special mustard sauce. I mopped up all the oil and all of the sauce with bread and drank the beer slowly until it began to lose its coldness, and then I finished it and ordered a demi and watched it drawn. It seemed colder than the distingué, and I drank half of it. I had not been worrying, I thought. I knew the stories were good and someone would publish them finally at home. When I stopped doing newspaper work, I was sure the stories were going to be published, but every one I sent out came back. What had made me so confident was Edward O'Brien's taking the My Old Man story for the Best Short Stories book, and then dedicating the book for that year to me. Then, I laughed and drank some more beer. The story had never been published in a magazine, and he had broken all his rules to take it for the book. I laughed again, and the waiter glanced at me. It was funny because, after all that, he had spelled the name wrong. It was one of two stories I had left when everything I had written was stolen in Hadley's suitcase, that time at the Gare de Lyon, when she was bringing the manuscripts down to me at Lausanne as a surprise, so I could work on them on our holidays in the mountains. She had put in the originals, the typescripts, and the carbons, all in the manila folders. The only reason I had the one story was that Lincoln Steffens had sent it out to some editor, who sent it back. It was in the mail while everything else was stolen. The other story that I had was the one called Up in Michigan, written before Miss Stein had come to our flat. I had never had it copied because she said it was inapproachable. It had been in a drawer somewhere. So, after we had left Lausanne and gone down to Italy, I showed the racing story to O'Brien, a gentle, shy man, pale, with pale blue eyes and straight, lanky hair he cut himself, who lived then as a boarder in a monastery up above Rapallo. It was a bad time, and I did not think I could write any more then, and I showed the story to him as a curiosity, as you might show, stupidly, the binnacle of a ship you had lost in some incredible way, or as you might pick up your booted foot and make some joke about it if it had been amputated after a crash. Then, when he read the story, I saw he was hurt far more than I was. I had never seen anyone hurt by a thing other than death, or unbearable suffering except Hadley, when she told me about the things being gone. She had cried and cried and could not tell me. I told her that no matter what the dreadful thing was that had happened, nothing could be that bad, and whatever it was all right and not to worry. We would work it out. Then, finally, she told me. I was sure she could not have brought the carbons, too, and I hired someone to cover for me on my newspaper job. I was making good money then at journalism, and took the train for Paris. It was true, all right, and I remember what I did in the night after I let myself into the flat and found it was true. That was over now, and Chink had taught me never to discuss casualties, so I told O'Brien not to feel so bad. It was probably good for me to lose early work, and I told him all that stuff you feed the troops. I was going to start writing stories again, I said, and, as I said it, only trying to lie so that he would not feel so bad, I knew that it was true. Then I started to think in lips about when I had first been able to write a story after losing everything. It was up in Cortina d'Ampezzo, when I had come back to join Hadley. There were after spring skiing which I had to interrupt to go on assignment to the Rhineland and the Ruhr. It was a very simple story called Out of Season, and I had omitted the real end of it, which was that the old man hanged himself. This was omitted on my new theory that you could omit anything if you knew that you omitted, and the omitted part would strengthen the story and make people feel something more than they understood. Well, I thought now I have them so they do not understand them. There cannot be much doubt about that. There is most certainly no demand for them, but they will understand the same way that they always do in painting. It only takes time, and it only needs confidence. It is necessary to handle yourself better when you have to cut down on food so you will not get too much hunger thinking. Hunger is good discipline, and you learn from it. And as long as they do not understand it, you are ahead of them. Oh, sure, I thought. I'm so far ahead of them now that I can't afford to eat regularly. It would not be bad if they caught up a little. I knew I must write a novel, but it seemed an impossible thing to do when I had been trying with great difficulty to write paragraphs that would be the distillation of what made a novel. It was necessary to write longer stories now, as you would train for a longer race. When I had written a novel before, the one that had been lost in the bag stolen at the Gare de Lyon, I still had the lyric facility of boyhood that was as perishable and as deceptive as youth was. I knew it was probably a good thing that it was lost, but I knew too that I must write a novel. I would put it off, though, until I could not help doing it. I was damned if I would write one because it was what I should do if we were to eat regularly. When I had to write, then it would be the only thing to do, and there would be no choice. Let the pressure build. In the meantime, I would write a long story about whatever I knew best. By this time, I had paid the check and gone out and turned to the right and crossed the Rue des Reines so that I would not go to the Deux Maigrets for coffee and was walking up the Rue Bonaparte on the shortest way home. What did I know best that I had not written about and lost? What did I know about truly and care for the most? There was no choice at all. There was only the choice of streets to take you back fastest that where you worked. I went to Bonaparte and Gournemer, then to the Rue d'Assas, up the Rue Notre-Dame des Champs, and the Closier de Lilas. I sat in a corner with the afternoon light coming in over my shoulder and wrote in the notebook. The waiter brought me a café crème, and I drank half of it when it cooled and left it on the table while I wrote. When I stopped writing, I did not want to leave the river, where I could see the trout in the pool, its surface pushing and swelling smooth against the resistance of a log-driven piles of the bridges. The story was about coming back from the war, but there was no mention of the war in it. But in the morning, the river would be there, and I must make it, and the country, and all that would happen. There were days ahead to be doing that each day. No other thing mattered. In my pocket was the money from Germany, so there was no problem. When that was gone, some other money would come in. All I must do now was stay sound and good in my head until morning, when I would start to work again.